Children exposed to violence. I guess I should start by talking about the concept, because there's a fair amount of confusion about the concept itself. Does it include the victimization of children in addition to the witnessing of violence? Well, yes, in most of its usage it does. But does it include exposure to media violence, like on television or the movies? Well, no, mostly doesn't. Well, how about nonviolent sex offenses against children, like sexual abuse? Most people who use this concept want it to include that, even though many of those acts do not involve actual violence. How different is this exposure to violence concept from child maltreatment, which is another concept that is widely used by people concerned about these same things? Well, child maltreatment has a large component of things like neglect and emotional maltreatment and abuse that most definitionally conscious social scientists have a hard time calling violence. If you think of violence as acts that are involving force that are committed with the intention of causing pain. But most policymakers want this covered under the concept of exposure to violence. I proposed a number of other concepts that I see as somewhat more definitionally defensible. Like I've used the term developmental victimology. I've also used the term childhood victimization. That's the title of my book on this subject. But I'm afraid these haven't caught on exactly. They're not commonplace. So it's too bad, in a way. We don't yet have an agreement on what to refer to all this as. I have been taken to calling this as much as possible exposure to violence, crime, and abuse to make sure that some of these other things are well included. What I think I can say is that almost everybody in the field is in agreement about the idea of moving in the direction of studying and advocating about a broader range of children's experiences, that what we've been doing up until now has been unfortunately fragmented. I sometimes like to use the term balkanized. I have a little cute little slide. I'm not even sure it's geographically correct anymore, but that illustrates that we have had a lot of research and advocacy in kind of separate, siloed, unconnected issues related to children's safety and victimization. But the recognition is that there are real benefits to looking at all of these things in a more comprehensive and holistic way. Among other things, it really gives us a better perspective on the full burden that kids experience in the way of these harm-generating kinds of experiences. We get to look at the interrelationships among these kinds of exposures, and many people suspecting that they're not independent, that they're occurring to the same kids, and that the risk for one increases the risk for another. A comprehensive view allows us to identify the kids who are really the highest risk and most victimized. It also allows us to appreciate better the developmental patterns as some of these things morph into other of these things as kids move up the age scale. It also promotes better collaboration. One of the key problems in the area is that a lot of the resources, the attention of policymakers or even school principals, is divided among people who are advocating for, you know, the bullying prevention program or the dating violence prevention program or the, you know, sexual abuse prevention program. And by collaborating, there's maybe a chance that more kids will get exposed to more prevention about more of these things. And there may be an opportunity to bootstrap more research if we really collaborate. So I've been spending a fair amount of my time trying to figure out ways in which we can promote a more comprehensive approach to this. And one of the main efforts I've made is to is on the issue of measurement, because it seemed to me when you have a way of gathering information and in a more comprehensive way, then people begin to think about it in the way that they can measure it. And this kind of approach was very effective in the field of delinquency, for example, where the self-reported delinquency measure, I think, was very instrumental in bootstrapping a lot of research about a comprehensive view of juvenile offending. So the juvenile victimization questionnaire, which we've been developing for the last 10 years, originally consisted of about 34 different kinds of exposures that tried to represent all the different kinds of things that advocates and researchers had been looking at, but also grouped into some of the modules or clusters that identified important subcategories that people might want to look at separately. And this included, topics that had received a lot of attention, like physical abuse, but topics that hadn't gotten much attention, like non-sexual assault of the genitals or burglary of a family household, and includes things that are, fairly common and things that are rather rare and unusual. But it is comprehensive. And we've had a chance now to utilize this in a wide range of both developmental and then national survey situations. And most recently, and what I'm going to talk about, is the National Survey of Children Exposed to Violence, funded by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which we have just been reporting some of the findings of, and is really our second large national survey with this kind of approach. These data that I will show you come from the survey that was conducted in 2008. So we're talking about events that occurred to these children in 2007 and 2008. And we were able to gather information on a nationally representative sample of over 4,500 children between the ages of infancy, 17. The data was collected by telephone interview. When the children were under the age of 10, we interviewed the caregiver with the most knowledge about the child's experiences. When the child was over the age of 9, between 10 and 17, we actually got permission and interviewed the youth themselves. In these interviews, we paid $20. We had an oversample of minority and low-income children, and we did pretty well in terms of our response rate. Now, in addition to the JVQ, we also expanded the kinds of questions and issues we were asking about on a number of dimensions, which you can see here. So, speaking of assault, you're going to get assaulted now by a lot of data. I'll try and pick out some of the important stuff that you might want to pay attention to. Overall, over 60% of the children had been exposed to something in the past year. I'm going to be talking about exposure in the past year. We also have lifetime exposure. I'm much more favorable to talking about past year exposure. I think it's more valid and more comparable. But in our reports, you will also find information on lifetime exposure if that's something of particular interest to you. 60% is a large number, but I also feel it's important to emphasize, because there's such a broad range of things that we're looking at here, including peer assaults and sibling assaults, I prefer actually not to focus on it or dwell on it. I think it's... Of course, one of the big values of what we've done here is that we have aggregate numbers as well as able to drill down and pick out specific topics of interest to people. And I think that's very important so that people can get a more complex view of actually what's going on. But you can see close to half the kids had been exposed to a physical assault in the past year. And then, you know, 1 in 10 maltreatment episode, 6% some sexual victimization. Another really valuable thing was the ability to really look for the first time at the trajectory of these experiences over the course of the full childhood. And you could see that rates were pretty high for some of them over pretty much the whole course of childhood, like physical assault, property victimization, for some kinds of exposures like sexual victimization, the witnessing of violence, and even the rates went up as kids got older. So I'm going to also just run through some of the specific types, but not dwell on these too long. I'll give you the reference for a couple of sources where you can get the specific information if you want it. So, for example, about 1 in 10 of the kids was actually injured over the course of the last year as a result of an assault. These bullying kinds of episodes are not included in the aggregate physical assault here. Substantial number of assaults by siblings, non-sibling peers. The summary, boys have higher rates of most assault and bullying victimizations. Highest rates among elementary school age kids, 6 to 9, but certain categories like dating violence, highest among teenagers. And as you can imagine, most of the perpetrators in these assaults are juvenile acquaintances and siblings. Here's the here are the findings on the sexual victimizations. Of course, sexual harassment, the largest category, but substantial numbers of assaults, attempted and completed rapes, of course, highest victimization among female teens. Adults are responsible about 15% of the total of sexual victimizations and 29% of the sexual assaults. Once again, primarily acquaintance perpetrators. These are the maltreatment rates. I think we probably did our worst job in the estimation of neglect, which is maybe you know from child protective statistics tends to be the largest category, but it's hard to really assess in a, because it takes so many forms, hard to assess in a survey format without really taking a huge amount of time. So I think we certainly underestimated that here. But substantial amount of physical abuse, psychological. The rates are similar for boys and girls, and rates are lowest for preschool age kids and actually grew as the kids got older. Property victimization, boys have higher rates, and once again, to the extent that the perpetrators were known, most of them were juvenile acquaintances. And then witnessing, which includes the witnessing of domestic violence, witnessing of physical abuse of siblings, includes witnessing of assaults in the community, and then some categories of things that have rarely been measured before, like kids exposed to warfare. These would be immigrant kids especially, the witnessing of family assaults, again, mostly teenagers. Now, one of the really interesting things that we were able to do is because we had done a very similar survey back in 2003, the Developmental Victimization Survey, we were actually able to look at some trend information. We'd use many of the same screening items, although we had a somewhat different sample, 2 to 17-year-olds as opposed to infants to 17. So these rates are comparing the sample, the 2 to 17-year-olds, in both the 2003 and the 2008 sample. And the very interesting and encouraging news is that we saw many more declines than we saw increases, and they were declines in areas of, like, particularly peer victimization, where there seems to have been a great deal of prevention effort during recent years. So a suggestion that maybe we're getting some return for that investment. So physical assaults declined. There was actually a pretty big increase in kids reporting robbery, but that was one of the few that increased. Overall, theft declined, burglary family households. These are the significant changes, the ones that are highlighted here. Declines in emotional and psychological maltreatment. Pretty substantial, almost 10% decline in peer and sibling victimization. Bullying, very big, almost by a third. Bullying, some significant decline in sexual assault, in sexual, what would be statutory sex crimes. Some increase in witnessing of sibling assault, but decrease in overall exposure to community violence. And this is the kind of the summary here. So declines in physical assault, sexual assault, peer and sibling, including physical bullying, psychological abuse, exposure to community violence, and theft. We did not see declines in caretaker physical abuse or neglect. And these two elements were an increase. But overall, it seems like very encouraging development and not inconsistent with what people have found in other surveys of exposures of this sort, like from the National Crime Victimization Survey. Another thing that the study has allowed us to do, and one of the reasons we were eager to do it, was to look at the interrelationship among different kinds of exposures. And as you would expect, having one kind of exposure does put you at considerably increased risk for other kinds of exposure. So, for example, if you had any physical assault in the course of the past year, you were about five times more likely to also experience a sexual victimization. And there's pretty much complete what I call transitivity among these kinds of exposures, in the sense that they virtually all lead to increased exposure to other kinds of victimizations. And of course, one of the things that this means is that some kids are experiencing a tremendous amount. And this is a slide that shows the number of separate, different kinds of victimization that a child reported having experienced in the last year, which ranged all the way up to about 22. In fact, a majority of the kids who were did have one or more of these had one exposure had at least two or more. But we also plotted this against some measures of psychological distress that we had in the survey. Not only did it show that, of course, the increasing number of exposures were associated with increasing amounts of distress, but it also showed that there was kind of a inflection point here at which, and this is a cut point that demarcates about 10% of the kids in the sample. And we've developed a term, or taken the term polyvictim, to refer to these kids who experience a very high level of victimization with a consequent high psychological impact. And the polyvictims, as you might imagine, not only have the highest number of victimizations, but the most serious kinds of victimizations. They're substantially more likely to have been injured in the course of victimization, to have faced a weapon-toting assailant, to have had a sexual victimization as part of their package of victimizations, or to have had a caregiver perpetrator involved in one of their victimizations. They also are, and this is one of the reasons why we think polyvictimization is so damaging, is that they have the victimization in a number of different domains, so that there's no real place of safety in their lives. They have these multiple environments where they get victimized. There is a somewhat larger percentage of polyvictims among the African American youth and among kids who have come from single parent or step family environments. Not as much association with SES. I'm going to, in the interest of time, skip over and just make a very important point, though, one that has been insufficiently recognized by people working in this field, and that is to say that most of the studies that we have on the impact of victimization or exposure to violence and childhood has been based on exposure to a single type of victimization or a single type of exposure, like sexual abuse or physical abuse or exposure to domestic violence. And because these studies have not really gotten a comprehensive assessment of all the different kinds of victimizations kids experience, they have tended to overestimate the contribution that a single type of victimization makes. And to illustrate this, what we did was to show the kinds of regression coefficients or associations you would get when you simply take something like sexual victimization and assault and correlate that or regress that with some trauma measure or psychological distress measure. And you get substantial coefficients here. But if you add the polyvictimization measure, that is the question of whether the kids are exposed to other kinds of victimization, the individual kind of exposure doesn't seem to make that much difference. So what's really going on with so many of these kids and so many of these findings of associations between, say, sexual victimization and distress is that it's the polyvictim kids in these samples who are carrying the distress. Another way of illustrating that is with these slides here, which show kids divided up into a number of groups. The non-victims, the kids who have a single kind of victimization, so say, let's say, in this case, the sexual victimizations, the sexually victimized kids, but divided into two groups. The kids with a low, either one or a very low number of that kind of victimization, sexual victimization. Kids who have chronic, that is a high number of those individual kind of victimizations, but are not polyvictims. And then the kids who have any of those sexual victimizations, but who are also polyvictims. And you can see how in every case, while the individual victimization may be associated with some elevation of distress, it's really the polyvictim kids who are the ones who are carrying the high levels of the problem. We're really trying to train a lot of our attention now on understanding more about this particular subgroup of polyvictimized kids. One of the things that we've done in some of our work now is to try and develop some notion about the pathways by which kids get into this kind of polyvictim condition. And we have a conceptual framework that suggests that maybe there are four major pathways: through living in dangerous neighborhoods, through having violent family environments, through having families which have substantial amounts of diversity, and through having existing mental health problems or disabilities. I don't have time to go into this in a great deal of detail, but suffice it to say that we have found some support for this in one of the longitudinal studies that we've been able to do, where we do find that each of these the variables associated with each of these pathways do seem to make an independent contribution to predicting the onset of polyvictimization in a longitudinal perspective. The other thing that turned out to be very interesting when we looked at this the onset of polyvictimization was that there seemed to be two main spikes, one at age 7 and one at age 15, which seemed to correspond to the first year in which these kids have entered into a new school environment, typically the moving into elementary school and moving into a high school. And we think that for kids who are vulnerable for developing this polyvictimization pattern, probably having to adapt to a new environment where they don't really, where there's a new social structure, a new status hierarchy, where there are lots of new routines that they have to accommodate to, where they have to make new friendships where the people who protect them and watch out for them or may not be, in the past are not available, where the parents themselves may be very anxious about the children's transition to these environments, where the parental control may be declining because of the children's graduation to these new environments. These are particularly vulnerable situations, and that we need to be doing a lot better job of picking up these kids, at-risk kids, early on in these environments and trying to improve our ability to reduce their descent into this kind of maelstrom of victimization. Just to summarize, we think there are many implications of this, but one is we need to assess kids who are much broader range of victimizations. We need to put more effort into identifying the most highly victimized kids. There's some differences in terms of early and later onset of this, and we need to sort of focus on that more. We need to look more at the relationship between this polyvictimization notion or the spectrum of victimizations and whether kids are also developing delinquent and aggressive patterns of behavior. We need to have treatment approaches that are more multifactorial and that take into account the fact that kids have had multiple exposures. We need to help people who work in some of these more balkanized or siloed areas like child protection to also get experience with and information about things like bullying and peer assault and dating violence so that they can direct resources towards kids who are vulnerable to that. If you want more information, there are two good sources for the overview. There's an article in Pediatrics in October 2009 that summarized a lot of the findings. There's also a Department of Justice publication, and there are many additional publications from the study, including ones focusing on polyvictimization that will be out in the near future. And then if you go to our website, there's a great deal more information about all this. Okay.